Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Well, welcome to Speaking of Reliability. I almost said Dare to Know. We were just chatting about the other program that we're working on, which is interviews with quality and thought leaders. And it's also on the reliability.fm network, podcast network that we're launching. So if you have a chance, go ahead and check that other show out. It's getting into the what's behind some of the people that have written the books or teach the courses or created companies that influence what we do in the reliability and the quality space. So Tim does the primary hosting on that. So I wanted to give you a plug for that show, Tim.
Thanks very much.
And then, and today's show, though, Tim and I are taking a look at supply chain. And in our previous discussion, we talked about the generic or the role, I shouldn't say generic, but the critical role of supply chain and how we work with our suppliers in order to maintain or achieve the reliability performance that our design is intending to accomplish. We could probably spend a whole year going through bits and pieces of what we talked about last time, Tim. Yet, I wanted to step back and just draw on our experience a little bit to underline how important it is. And in the news this past year, there's been issues with lithium ion batteries in aircraft.
Right.
I've tried not to name names and point fingers. There was a unintended acceleration issue blamed on a floor mat.
Right.
Right. There was a, what was the airbag? The last I heard is that there's a propellant that's used in airbag assemblies that works kind of like an explosive that shoots the airbag out into its inflated form. And one of the things I heard was that if that propellant gets too much moisture, it becomes even more aggressive in its explosion, which has then led to injuries.
Right.
In each case, though, it's probably not the nameplate of the organization that created that component. Right. It's our supply chain.
That's right.
I'm sure you remember this story from when we were at HP. I probably should edit that part out. But it was a story we told just about everybody. And so one day I'm at my desk. I'm a manufacturing engineer. I get a phone call from a customer that says that she wanted to know where she could buy the maintenance kit for an inkjet printer. And I'm like, a maintenance kit? What's that about? And she goes, it was something that you put in the printer and it would clean the pick roller, the rollers to pick the paper.
Right. Yeah.
And so I asked a couple of questions about that. And everybody there that had been there for a few years knew about the story. It was that apparently the design was trying to cost reduce a little bit. And there's a metal bar that sits where the paper feed is, where the paper tray is, and has a little rubber roller on it that would be what would touch the paper.
Right.
And when you would want to feed a new piece of paper into it, it would just kick that top sheet of paper into the mechanisms and it'd feed it into the printer.
Right. You need some friction between that roller and the paper.
Right. And I think the specification was for a certain tackiness.
Yeah.
Right. Because if it was too tacky, it would damage the paper.
Right.
And if it wasn't tacky enough, it would just spin and not pick the paper up. And so the story was is that the process went through, this component was engineered into the part or into the design. The metal bar had a pick roller, originally it was a separate component that was positioned and then fixed into place. Mm-hmm. And the improved design, quote, air quotes here, was to mold it directly onto the bar. And unbeknownst, to make a long story short, unbeknownst to people was that in order to mold that part, the molder had to use a additive to the material set that was a mold release agent or a byproduct of the molding process. And it had the unpleasant behavior of migrating to the surface and creating like a Teflon coating, basically, a very slick coating. And if the printer was not used every day, right, not used frequently, which would then just wear off anything that came to the surface, it would accumulate enough that it would stop being able to pick up the paper, become too slick.
Right. And if I remember right, the maintenance kit that the customer was talking about was basically some spring-loaded Scotch-Brite or something.
Sandpaper
pad. That was meant to roughen the surface of the roller.
Just knock off that coating that bloomed to the surface. And I remember in the reliability side of things, we were like, well, why didn't we catch this? We did all of these different tests. And so we did, you know, hundreds of thousands of pages got printed, but we printed constantly for weeks.
Yeah.
And it just never got a chance to bloom. And we did cold testing. We did hot testing. We did all these things. And it turned out when I was talking to a chemist is that the ability of that stuff to bloom, to migrate, worked best at room temperature, right? So if you made it cold.
All of your efforts to accelerate, you know, using temperature were not helping.
That's right. And you know, talking to the supplier, it was like, well, if I don't use that, we can't make this part.
Right.
That was part. It's in all the drawings we provided. It's in everything we did. We didn't know it would be a slick, you know, coating at the end of the day. And so it was, part of it was we didn't know what we were looking for.
Yep.
Right. But also part of it was that it was an additive to a material used in a different building for the molding process, which was then assembled into a printer, which.
Right.
Yeah.
Nobody did anything wrong, but they just didn't really understand what the impact was going to be on the total product, the complete system.
You know, that's right.
And we see these kind of situations all the time where, again, when you have suppliers that are located, you know, a long way away from your operation, a long way away from the design group, the only thing they really have to go on is what's in the drawing or what's in the emails or other communications with the supplier. You know, they don't really have that deep understanding of the system. Of course, the designers themselves may not have a good understanding of how the system operates either, but we can't expect the supplier to know more. They're going to look at the information they're provided and say, well, we assume you know what you're doing and that if we just deliver what you've requested, that it will work in your system. And this may be a case where I think we talked last time, Fred, about the lack of understanding of production and manufacturing processes in the design community. So there are probably a lot of folks, a lot of the mechanical engineers who worked on that design who really didn't know much about molding and would never have anticipated that a mold release agent would have that kind of effect.
Mm-hmm. And in most applications, that release agent is benign. It doesn't matter whether the tackiness changes or not.
Right.
It's this one characteristic.
Yeah. So, you know, we see this kind of stuff happen a lot. Again, when I was at Foxconn, we had, we worked with a lot of suppliers of suppliers. You know, we mentioned before about how this issue of the impact that suppliers have on reliability is becoming more and more and more complex, not only because companies are using more suppliers, but the suppliers themselves, their primary suppliers, also have suppliers. Mm-hmm. And so again, it's like that old game of telephone where the key performance parameters, the key dimensions are not being effectively communicated all the way through the supply chain. People are doing their best. I'll give them the benefit of the doubt and say everybody's trying to do their best.
Right.
But it's not creating, it's creating a problem because they don't have a good understanding of how this all relates to total product reliability. So,
I'm thinking of a couple different examples of that. I'm sure you've got a couple also.
Yeah. Well, we had a situation it was some kind of conductive ink that had to be used on the control panel of this printer that we were making. In fact, this is embarrassing. I don't remember if it was supposed to be conductive or if it was supposed to be non-conductive. I think it was supposed to be conductive because we were trying to minimize static issues. So okay. We wanted to create a, you know, a, like not a Faraday cage, but you know what I mean? We wanted to provide some shielding capability. Well, we had a supplier. This was a supplier to Foxconn, and Foxconn was supplying HP. And, you know, we just didn't effectively communicate the importance of this non-conductive ink and that it had to be non-conductive. It had to be conductive. And so the supplier, as a cost savings measure, selected a different ink that was non-conductive.
Looked the same color, yeah. And coating.
I'm sure it did. Yeah. And this isn't the kind of thing that you test for routinely. You know, this isn't the kind of thing that this showed up later when we were doing electrostatic testing mm-hmm. on the overall printer. So, you know, this kind of stuff happens a lot, again, because we don't effectively communicate what our requirements are and how important these are to the overall reliability of the product.
It's very, very true. There was one years ago, and I think it's coming back, is we use flame retardants in a lot of electronics mm-hmm. Encapsulants. And there's been a series of regulations, mostly out of Europe and other countries in the world, that are trying to get rid of some of these hazardous chemicals. And flame retardants almost always are hazardous to something. Mm-hmm. But one of them is called red phosphorus.
Sure.
And it's a particular type of chemical composition, primarily phosphorus, that reacts to heat and flame. And it basically is pretty aggressive. And I don't remember whether it just tries to blow out the flame or if it creates water. I don't remember what its flame mm-hmm. retardant behavior is. But the chemical itself is very corrosive. And so think of it as you're putting your custom ASIC together and you have this plastic epoxy, I should say, overcoating. It's filled with corrosive chunks of material. Mm-hmm. Sometimes like 20-30% of the bulk is this phosphorus. And so some years ago, it was across the whole industry. I mm-hmm. talked to a couple of colleagues about it. They were seeing it in all kinds of industries, but it showed up in applications that had a little bit of vibration. So things that were car mounted or hard drives would shake out a little bit of that red phosphorus out of mm-hmm. the molding, and it would corrode the components and cause shorts and all kinds sure. of problems. And the root cause was the folks that made the chips, made the molding part, were buying the epoxy as a blend that had this flame retardant in it from another company. The company that made that blend would buy the red phosphorus from a supplier that would extract the phosphorus raw materials and put it into a certain composition suitable for this flame retardant application. Well, somebody changed the filter for the particle size in wow. order to improve throughput in their line. And it changed the dimensions of the particles, which were then more likely to come out of the molded compound.
Right.
Now, this red phosphorus stuff's used in all kinds of different applications. So the likelihood that red phosphorus supplier knew that it would impact the in plastic encapsulants capabilities was probably the last thing on their mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, they're making a good decision for their own process. They're, they and yet it impacted millions of components in millions of products.
So again, we've got a couple of problems here. We've got a design team that doesn't really understand the production process and doesn't feel that they should need to understand the production process. And so they can't look at the supplier's process and say, by the way, you need to be careful about the particle size of the red phosphorus that you're using. You know, the design team doesn't have that insight or that understanding.
Well, they don't have the capability either.
It's absolutely.
Tens of thousands of details like that.
And then conversely, the supplier is going to be highly motivated to run their standard process. They don't want to customize their production process any more than necessary.
Right.
So they're going to run their standard process unless told otherwise. You know, they're going to run, you know, the same process that they use to make all their other parts. Unless somebody steps in and says, by the way, you've got to make a process change here because our parts are sensitive to this particular, you know, characteristic. And this is going to create a reliability problem for us. So you don't find this stuff out until you have a field failure of some kind or you have customer returns. I'm impressed that you were able to get that level of detail from the root cause analysis.
Well, there's a lot of smart people working on it. We could talk about ceramic capacitors. We could talk about molded parts. We could talk about, the list goes on and on and on as to how some seemingly insignificant detail impacts the design. So
that's right.
What do you do? I mean, as a reliability professional or as a procurement professional, I think this is going to be a topic for another discussion.
Yeah. But it's hard because, again, there's information that's missing on both sides. Mm-hmm. Let's face it, you don't need to spend this much time and attention on every part. But you do need to understand what the critical performance parameters are and what those subsystems are that contribute mm-hmm. to the performance parameters of your product, the overall reliability of the product. And that really does have to start with the design team. They're the ones, you know, whether it's using an FMEA analysis or something similar, they're the ones that are going to have the best understanding of what needs to be controlled and monitored in order to deliver a good product. And then that information needs to trickle down. You can't just send suppliers drawings or emails. You need to sit down with them. Again, for those, not for everything, but for the critical components.
That's right.
You know, do you need to have that conversation with your fastener suppliers or, you know, the folks that give you screws and nuts and bolts? Well, probably not. Although in some cases, I would argue that you do.
Reminds me of another story.
Yeah. So you've got to be careful not to underestimate the impact of suppliers on reliability, even for parts like that. But you need to sit down with them and help them understand the overall system. I'm sure we're going to come back to this later, but a lot of this also comes down to who you choose as your suppliers. Mm-hmm. If your supplier doesn't have the engineering capability, doesn't have the knowledge to be able to sit down with you and have that conversation about reliability, then I would suggest they're not the right supplier. If they're dead set on running their standard process, if they're not open to, you know, customizing their production process in order to meet your reliability requirements, then they're probably not the right supplier. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it would be worth it to you to spend a little more money to find a supplier that does have internal engineering capability to be able to comprehend what it is you're telling them about the critical performance parameters and understand the implications to their production processes.
Yeah. No, good summary. I think we'll probably just wrap it up right there because I did two things. Is one is this is important. It ties that communication branch goes back, but it's also a hint at what we need to do. And we'll certainly come back and talk about some more of those things. So in the next show, Tim, one of the questions we've gotten is, what do I do when our organization is looking for the lowest cost suppliers.
Mm. Yeah.
Right? You know, what do we do with that? So let's save that topic for the next show.
Good deal.
All right. Thanks, Tim.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.